Hey friends, it's me, Shane Blackshear, your host. You probably know by now that Compassion International is a sponsor of Seminary Dropout, and all the things I've told you before, that I'm so excited, that my wife and I have sponsored a child for almost a decade now, a couple of kids actually, and that I recently went on a trip with Compassion to Sri Lanka, and it was fantastic, and you should go check that out in Seminary Dropout 156. Was it 156? That's right, 156. Well, it occurred to me that I haven't told you one of the greatest things, one of the greatest things selfishly about Compassion International, and that's receiving a letter from your sponsored child. If you listen to Seminary Dropout 156, I told you about meeting our new sponsor child. His name is Seetham, and I had a great time just getting to know him. He was kind of shy, so you know I tried to not be over anxious around him. But today I got the first letter, and it was so good to just read his words. They were so sweet. They were so kind. And then also he drew this great picture of the scenery where he lives, and it was just so cool to receive that letter, and it's something that we look forward to. It's one of the small things that's not so small that Compassion does that makes their program so great and unique, and I know that Seetham is getting all that he needs. He's getting fed and he's getting schooling. Compassion's actually helping his family build a house, and I love that. And he knows about my life because we're going to be writing him letters back too. So we get this wonderful, special relationship between my family and his. And I can't say enough about Compassion International. Go, please sponsor. If you've been on the fence, go to compassioninternational.com/dropout. You can get any of your questions answered there. Or if you got more questions, hey, contact me. I'll answer them. But go there, compassion.com/dropout. Sponsor a child today. Okay. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! Hey friends, just a quick note before this episode starts. If I can be honest, I'm always a little bit nervous when I do a podcast or write something online that's a little bit controversial. I do not relish debating or conflict at all, really. It's just, I don't have a stomach for it. It's not my personality. But nevertheless, I think it's important to talk about important issues. And today on the podcast, we're talking about abortion. A lot of times when there's talk of abortion, you hear people say things like, well, if you're really going to be pro-life, then you need to talk about or address the death penalty or war and violence or racism or poverty. And to that I say, absolutely, I'm completely with you. And so if that's you, then I would really encourage you to go check out the episode of Seminary Dropout with Shane Claiborne, where we talk about the death penalty, to listen to all of the episodes of Seminary Dropout where we've talked about war and violence, all the episodes where we've talked about racism and the problem of racism in America today, all the episodes where we've talked about poverty. I wholeheartedly agree. All of those things are, to me, very much a part of a pro-life ethic. And so this is just one piece of that. Now, even having said that, there will be some of you out here who disagree with things that are said in this podcast. And if you want to, talk about it with me on Facebook or Twitter or the comments section of this, I welcome it. But what I will ask is that we all respect just the human dignity, the image of God in each other when we do those things. So with that spirit, I want to go on to this great interview. My guest is Karen Swallow Pryor. Karen is a professor of English at Liberty University. She's the author of several books and contributes to Christianity Today, The Atlantic, and Relevant Magazine, among other publications. And for the second time, Karen, thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Thanks for having me. I think it's been a little while, so it's good to be back.
It has. We were talking about Fierce Convictions whenever that came out. Was that a couple years ago now?
Yeah, that's been, it'll be three years this fall. So yeah, wow, time flies.
Really does.
Time flies when you're not writing a book.
Feels like yesterday. So I mentioned you've written for several publications. One of the things that you write on a lot is life issues and specifically abortion. I don't know how, but after 155 episodes, we've never done an episode specifically on it. We've talked about other life issues and things like the death penalty and even poverty and stuff like that, things that I have a conviction are connected, but never about this. And I think it's because I wanted to give it the proper attention it deserves and really talk with someone who was also concerned about truth, because it's really hard to find actual facts surrounding abortion and find someone who has the knowledge to talk about it. And I've read so many things that you've written, and I think you're just the perfect guest to talk about this. So I'm curious why this became an issue that you become passionate about.
I mean, the short version is, and I'll flesh it out a little bit more, but the short version is that, if I were to pick an issue that I would want to be concerned about in my human nature and the way that my mind thinks and my passions are aligned, this would probably be one of the last ones. It's just simply when I became pro-life, and I'll talk about that, it just came on me with such conviction and such passion and such power that I just was compelled by the Holy Spirit to get involved, to stay involved and devoted. For about 10 years of my life, I was really involved in pro-life activism, like a full-time job that I wasn't getting paid for, but it's just something that the Lord called me to, and a conviction that He gave me. And it started really, it's when my little country Baptist church that my husband and I were attending back in upstate New York, the pastor was going to have a sermon on abortion. And I remember thinking, I wonder what he's going to say about abortion, because I've not really ever thought about it before. This is going back a ways. And because of an unexpected emergency at my job, we had to miss that sermon. And this is why I remember it so well. But that evening, that Sunday evening, the church was having the local crisis pregnancy center come and do a presentation. So I made sure that I attended that. And that's where they showed this very now infamous video called The Silent Scream, which was narrated by a former abortionist named Bernard Nathanson, who eventually became a Catholic believer. But he basically showed what happens during a first trimester abortion through a sonogram screen. Now, mind you, this video was being shown on a little tiny TV standing on a little rickety cart up at the front of the church, and I'm sitting in the back. So I cannot even make out what is showing on the screen, but I can hear the narration and I can hear the words. And I just understood for the first time that even a very early abortion is a tiny, tiny little baby with a heartbeat and limbs and a face and fingers and toes that is being destroyed. But even more than that, I thought how horrible it must be to be a woman and feel like that is your best choice. And I walked away from that evening service thinking, I want to help women not to have to make that choice. And I have had that conviction these many years since.
So there's so many angles to go through. And I think I want to just talk a little bit about just the science, the medical science of what's happening. There's a lot of opinions about when life begins, but I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, scientifically what happens to the life of an embryo and then a fetus, and like what, at what stage is what is happening at what stage, I guess, is a question I want to ask.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it depends on what we mean by human life and what we mean by personhood. And so many people, when they talk about when human life begins, they really don't mean biological human life. They mean personhood, or they mean ensoulment or consciousness or awareness. And those are really important things. I'm rather fond of all of them myself. So I don't have any strict answers on those. I don't know the answers to those questions, but I know that biologically a new human entity begins with the fertilization of the egg by the sperm. I know that's true not only of human beings, but I know that my beloved dogs, Ruby and Eva, that they were made brown and gray with little white flecks on them, and their color eyes and their small size, everything about them was created at the moment that, you know, that those two dogs, sperm and eggs cells joined together, and that formed those particular dogs that I know and love. And the same is true for every human person. Lots of things can happen in the meantime, and, you know, maybe we'll get to that. But just on a biological level, a new human entity, a human being, is formed at that moment. And that doesn't resolve all of the questions or the problems or the concerns or the contingencies that follow from it. But it just seems very clear to me that it's a scientific fact that, you know, a new person is created then, a person who will become someone. And that someone could be a variety of things that we do not yet know and would not yet know. But that is whoever that person is and is going to be begins then, in the same sense that the person that I was going to be after I was born, or when I was 3 years old, or when I was 12 years old, was also continuing to become and grow and develop, and hopefully still today.
I read something not too long ago that kind of gave me pause, and that was about embryos and their development. And there's this guy, this bioethicist named Leroy Walters, and he's the one who came up with the 14-day rule. Do you know about that, Karen?
Is this with implantation?
So the idea is, with research with embryos, there's a generic rule of thumb. It's a guideline here in the U.S. In some places it's law, but when experiments are being done on embryos, they can't do experiments or keep those embryos alive past 14 days. Mm-hmm. And the 14-day rule, Leroy Walters came up with that. And basically in the 70s, when they're trying to find guidelines, this was just after Roe v. Wade was passed. So they're trying to figure out, like, well, where is the line? Mm-hmm. When they're experimenting with embryos, how long can they keep those alive? And so they had a commission. Leroy Walters is one of them. He testifies and he says, you know, most conservative side would just be, we can't use them at all because, you know, there's after conception, there's something there. And then in the most, allowable side, I think he said like 8 weeks. And that's when I think he said like a central nervous system starts developing. And somebody said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, I think about 14 days is a good rule. And he was basing it on the idea that basically after 5 days or before 5 days, about 50% of embryos are like discharged naturally from the body. And so kind of the idea is, like, if these things are morally significant, then why are half of them naturally being flushed out of the system? Does that make sense?
It does. And I've not heard of the 14-day rule or this particular researcher, but I have actually been asked that question a number of times because there have been some other studies that show that, you know, 50% of fertilized eggs fail to implant, or some number like that. But no one has yet even attempted, in my discussions about that question, to explain why that fact makes these fertilized eggs morally insignificant. I mean, 100% of us, you know, born fully developed human beings will also die at some point. So why does the fact that an early natural death that occurs even 50% of the time make, how does that change the moral significance of the fertilized egg? I mean, I think probably, you know, that there are reasons why a fertilized egg like that would naturally miscarry or fail to implant, but that natural act or that natural phenomenon does not, I'm not following, I've never heard anyone explain why that then makes it okay for us to, you know, to intentionally prematurely end that life.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is, it's almost like, well, we don't know if we could only experiment on that 50% that we're going to die anyway, fair enough, but we don't know what that 50% is. And all of us came from, were at that one, that stage one time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, that isn't, I'm glad that you raised that, because that is, you know, a point that has been made multiple times to me. And it's just, okay, so 50% of fertilized eggs die on their own. Okay. Someone has to make the connection for me for why that means that the 50% or whatever it is that don't, therefore are not, you know, unique human entities.
Sure. I think, to play devil's advocate, I think the logic is, so, you know, if we're going to even take a Christian worldview, if God is granting these embryos personhood, why then is he like designing the human body, or however you want to phrase it, to expel half of them before we even get a say in the matter? I think that's the logic there.
Okay. Well, why did he design the human body so that we are all going to decay and die anyway?
Sure.
Right. I mean, if we believe this is a tiny, tiny human being that dies at 24 hours or, you know, or a few days old, that's just an earlier death than most of us will experience, or half of us will experience, I guess.
That's true. I want to get into some stats, and then also just
which is not my favorite subject, but I'll do the best that I can. but I do think it is important to get a grasp on this issue, to know exactly what we're talking about, because I think a lot of people just don't even know. But so go ahead.
Yeah, I just found a great literary mind, and then I invited her on the show to talk about stats.
Yeah, what were you thinking?
And then also some policy stuff. So in the U.S., what are the parameters on abortion? Like, when, how late? And I think that probably varies from state to state, but...
Oh. I'm so glad you asked this question.
Go ahead.
All right. So, yeah. So state law does vary. However, what Roe versus Wade established, the Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion... most of us are familiar with Roe versus Wade because the media reports on it all the time. It broke up this pregnancy into trimesters and said that essentially that the states could not regulate abortion or outlaw abortion within the first two trimesters, and could in the last trimester, but they could not outlaw abortion in the last trimester if the mother's life or health were in danger. What most people don't know, and very few media outlets ever report when talking about abortion, is that on the same day that Roe versus Wade was handed down, the court also handed down a decision called Doe versus Bolton, which defined health and life of the woman. And they included a definition that's so broad that it literally includes familial health. So in other words, when you take the two rulings together, which is how the court designed them to be, a state cannot outlaw abortion in the last trimester if it affects the woman's health, mental health, family health, which basically covers everything.
Family, so, what do they mean by family health?
Well, if her family's health, the health and status and welfare of her family might be, hurt by having another child. So familial health. So if her, in other words, if her reason is that my family can't bear the burden of another child or this child, because oftentimes there are reasons, other reasons that go along with it. then the state cannot prohibit her from having an abortion. So effectively, abortion is legal through the moment of birth in all 50 states.
And there haven't been states that have restricted that?
Because there are restrictions on the books, but if a woman were to seek an abortion, you know, in the ninth month of pregnancy and not get it, she would have a case. Also, the more pragmatic situation for this is just simply that you're not going to find providers in every state who are going to provide abortions this late, even if they can. So the law says, you know, one thing, and then what's actually practiced ends up looking a little bit different. But late term abortions are, you know, are constitutionally legal for virtually any reason through the moment of birth.
Okay. So that's
pretty. And anyone can Google this. I mean, look it up, Doe versus Bolton.
Yeah. Okay. So that's pretty significant. I mean, up till basically, you just got to be on the wrong side of the birth canal to be legally aborted, basically.
Right. Which is why, and you know, it's been a few years, but there've been a couple of pieces of legislation like the Born Alive Act, which was to make it illegal to kill an infant who survived an abortion, you know, who was supposed to be aborted but survived, made that illegal, and then the partial birth abortion legislation, which meant that the abortion had to be completed while the child was still with completely in the birth canal. So, I mean, we wouldn't have these pieces of legislation if they weren't things that were happening. Now, of course, they are not the norm. No, you know, I'm certainly not going to pretend that women in masses are getting abortions at 9 months. However, when we look at the number of abortions that take place, you know, around the country on an annual or even daily basis, those numbers themselves are so staggering that even a small percentage of them that might be later still is far more common than most people imagine.
Yeah. There has been, this is really tangential. I hesitate even to mention it, but there are movements out there for what they're calling afterbirth abortion. And I don't want to pretend that all abortion proponents or pro-choice proponents are for that, but you have to see that the logical conclusion of it's okay if it's on that side of the birth canal leads to why is it different on this side of it?
Right. I mean, that there is a logic there. There's more logic in that kind of position or in Peter Singer's position. Peter Singer is the, professor of ethics at Princeton University. I recently spoke on a panel with him actually about abortion up at Princeton. But, his position is that that a family should have up until about 2 years after birth to decide whether or not to welcome the child into the family. You know, he's really thinking of severe deformities that might not make themselves, the extent of them might not be evident until about 2 years. And because he thinks that consciousness and self-awareness develops at about two, that's where he draws the line. Which again, I think is morally horrific, but there is a consistency there. If he thinks that if one thinks that human beings are merely animals, without souls and everything that goes along with that, then yeah, there's a consistency there in that position.
Well, you bring up the idea of disabilities. I find it so interesting that the secular progressive way of thinking is to give much dignity, and I affirm this, give much dignity to those with disabilities. And yet often a reason for abortion is given is some sort of disability or Down syndrome or something like that.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think we have to understand and affirm the impulse behind that because it is one of compassion, but the Bible says the compassion of the wicked is cruel. And I think this is an example of that. I mean, there's a lot of projection that goes on there because we have a sense, well, I wouldn't want to live a life like that. I mean, and we do this all the time. I look at someone else's suffering and I think, oh, I'm so glad I'm not suffering in that way. And so we think that someone who has a disability, someone who has Down syndrome, is suffering simply because we can't even really imagine it. Although if you know any people who have these kinds of disabilities, they are by and large very glad to be alive. And I think studies have shown that, you know, statistically they are generally happier to be alive than the general population. So there is a compassion, albeit misguided compassion, on the part of many who think this way. And it's simply wrong, because, you know, even on the other end of the life spectrum, and I know you mentioned that, you know, your own pro-life views are holistic as are mine, that we, when it comes to even euthanasia, it's often our desire to embrace euthanasia is more about saving ourselves from the way that we suffer when we watch other people suffer. Mm. And it's really important that we recognize that. Especially as Protestants, you know, I am one, so I get to critique my community. But we do not have a good theology of suffering or the body, which of course entails suffering. Nor does our culture. We really just want to avoid suffering as much as we can, and this shows up very powerfully in these life issues.
Hmm. I think I was like reading an article from a pro-choice proponent or some video or something. And one of the things that they mentioned was that when abortion is outlawed, you have more, the way they phrased it was so clever. You have more disabilities present in the population. Mm-hmm. And I thought, whoa, what are you doing there? I can't believe that flies. That's crazy. Okay, so back to stats. How many abortions happen in the U.S. each year?
Well, it's, you know, if you look at, and I've been involved in this issue for a lot, so with the long view in mind, what's been encouraging is that abortion has been decreasing fairly steadily over the past couple of decades.
Right.
I mean, it used to be the number for annual abortions performed in the U.S. annually would be over 1 million. And now it's generally under 1 million, close to, you know, the figure I'm looking at now is that in 2014, the last year they have data, it was 926,240, which is down from over 1 million in 2011. But those are still huge numbers. I mean, when I first started as an activist in this movement, the number was that 1 in 3 pregnancies were ending in abortion. Now it's 1 in 4, which is a pretty significant improvement, but it's still 1 in 4 of every pregnancy ends in abortion. This is not, I mean, I think so many people have the idea that abortion is just, you know, it's just something rare and unusual and unfortunate, but it's just something that's the best choice every now and then in extreme circumstances. 1 in 4 does not match up with that kind of narrative about abortion just being a rare thing in desperate circumstances. 1 in 4 means that our entire economy, our family structure, our social structure, our medical structure, our sexual ethics, our everything that is utterly dependent upon abortion. When we have 1 in 4 pregnancies ending in abortion, our whole lives as a society depend on abortion, because how different would our society be if most of these babies were born, or if most of these unwanted pregnancies never happened in the first place?
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, the desperate situation. Out of the abortions, how many are those that were pregnancies caused by rape or incest? Do we have good stats on that?
Well, I don't have the latest ones, but pretty consistently, and I'm going to be conservative here, the number, I mean, this was actually being generous. The number of the so-called hard cases are like 5% of all abortions. And within that, maybe 1 or 2% of, you know, rape, incest, or disability. Now, that number may have changed from a few years ago when I last looked at it, but it is the vast, vast, vast minority of abortions.
Well, part of the reason that I ask that is because I know a lot of good people who are pro-choice because of that 5%. And it seems odd to allow about 1 million abortions so that 5% of 1 million can have abortions, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. There's an entire false narrative about abortion that has allowed it to continue so long and so generally unchallenged. People just have a perception that the hard cases comprise far more of them than they do.
I hear on the news often about other cases where basically because of the law in someone's jurisdiction, they have to give birth to a stillborn baby because they can't remove that body because of abortion laws. And I also hear that reason given for supporting about 1 million abortions.
I've not heard that. I know that there was some legislation pending in Texas and about the removal or what to do with fetal remains, whether it was abortion or stillborn. But that is just such an extreme situation that it's, you know, I mean, there's an old saying that bad case makes bad law. We should never make laws based on the exceptions in any area. But especially when we're talking about something life and death. But of course, I mean, all laws need to take into account and make provision for any kind of unusual circumstance. But we certainly shouldn't have national policy that affects our lives so deeply based on the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah, I'm going to. I thought I was going to double check my sources and if not, edit that out. So I'm going to find out. I'm finding stories. Woman forced to give birth to stillborn in Texas because of something. So I'm going to double check my source before I leave this in here. And if I don't, you'll never hear me saying this. So that'll be fine. Because I'm always passionate about truth, but especially with this issue, because there's so much misinformation on both sides. I definitely don't want to be part of any fake news, even if it supports my argument.
Right. I mean, I've always just been an advocate of letting the facts speak for themselves. I mean, of course, they're not going to convince everyone, but for me, as I shared in the opening story about how I became alive, for me, the facts were just enough. It just changed everything for me. And I think that's true, not of everyone, but of a lot of people. If we just knew what was really going on, it would make a huge difference.
Well, let's talk about Planned Parenthood a little bit, because a lot of the conversation around abortion has to do with Planned Parenthood. A lot of the laws, especially recently, because I think our Congress just voted to take away funds from Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, they voted to allow states to withhold funding. Right, yeah. Which they were not allowed to before, I guess.
Yeah, I think they weren't allowed to on the basis that they also provided abortions, I think was the language there. So one of the arguments that people give in support of Planned Parenthood is that they do a lot more than abortion, and that they're the only health care provider for some women in the country. What, other than abortion, what does Planned Parenthood do?
Well, you know, that is something that's really hard to get a straight answer on. I mean, their name tells us what they exist mainly for. It's Planned Parenthood is for pregnancy prevention and reproductive health services. It's pretty straightforward. I think part of the problem is it's Planned Parenthood is such a huge organization with so many sites that in so many cities and communities that operate probably somewhat differently, that they probably aren't all the same. So there may be a couple that offer more comprehensive services, and then, you know, they can say that they offer these. But, you know, I'm looking at the site for my local Planned Parenthood, which is actually not in my city, but in the next city over. And, you know, when you go to book and they ask you to select the reason that you want to book an appointment, there, all of the reasons that you can select other than other is, are related to reproductive health services, birth control, morning after pill, pregnancy tests, and so forth. In the a place where I can click on general health care, there are some other, some screenings and blood tests that are offered as well, but it's nothing about cancer, nothing about anything that you would go, you know, other than just a few screening or blood tests, and then it's just reproductive health services. I think it's, you know, and I don't know of any community, even my own rural community that I live in, that doesn't provide healthcare services for the uninsured or the underinsured. The way the healthcare law is now is that a hospital cannot refuse care to you if you walk into the emergency room. It's just impossible. So there are, I do not know of anyone, not that this is just anecdotal, obviously, that goes to Planned Parenthood for general health care. I have never heard of a person who does that. But again, I don't know if we can conclusively say that no Planned Parenthood ever has provided this cancer screening or that or so forth. I suppose that if you go in for an STD examination and it shows some abnormal cells, then that might send you to another place that might be an indication of cancer, and perhaps they would call that cancer screening. I don't know. You know, I think for everyone's sake, we just all need to be honest about what it is that they are about, and whether or not we as a society want that publicly funded. And I think that probably, sadly, we do. And that Christians and pro-lifers need to come up with some alternative healthcare solutions for women that are more holistic. If we want to put Planned Parenthood out of business, it's not going to happen overnight. But I'm glad to see that these questions are being raised, and that Planned Parenthood is having to defend itself as it should be.
Well, you made me think of another question as you were talking right then. How does payment work at Planned Parenthood? Is that a sliding scale? I'm sure if you've got insurance, they're happy to take it. But if you're indigent, is it free for women who go in for whatever the service?
The site that I'm looking at just simply says that payment is expected at the time of service. The way that I think that it works is simply because it does get government funding, it probably has either a prorated scale or just reduced rates for service because of the clients that they are serving. But it doesn't indicate in any way that it's free. It says that payment is due at the time of service.
I mean, I understand that someone, you know, breaks an arm or has an emergency, they're going to go to an ER and they're going to get treated no matter what. I do understand that probably most women aren't going to go to an ER for like a cancer screening, like breast cancer screening.
Right.
And if they don't have funds and they don't have insurance, they're probably not going to go to a regular doctor. I mean, they're probably not going to schedule an appointment for something preventative in that way. And so I know Planned Parenthood kind of positions themselves as the answer to that problem.
Yeah, I don't see anything here about mammograms, which are really one of the most important cancer screenings available for women. And, you know, it's crucial for women over a certain age and or with certain predispositions to get. There's nothing here for that. I mean, when I was a teenager, Planned Parenthood, which is a long time ago, granted, but I mean, Planned Parenthood was just the place you went to get your birth control so your parents wouldn't know. Just to be totally blunt about it.
Because it's kind of a no questions asked. I think they just did they just like hand it out there.
Right. Which is the no questions asked part is one of the things that has gotten or should have gotten Planned Parenthood into even more trouble, because when underage girls are going there for abortions and being brought in by older men, you know, and there's any indication that there may be some kind of statutory rape or sexual abuse going on, that is something that that would make those healthcare providers mandated reporters. As an educator, I'm a mandated reporter. But that's been another area where Planned Parenthood has had to be investigated, but really has not been held to account. Is are they helping to cover up the rapes of underage girls by family members or other men?
Well, I think something you said earlier really should be the takeaway, is that Christians should be really providing alternatives to this. Places where poor women can go and get good health care, can be taken care of. And then just also on the front of giving birth, it is incredibly expensive to give birth in this country. In helping with things like adoption, and also helping creating circumstances in which it is easy for a mother to keep her baby and take care of it.
Right. And of course, the crisis pregnancy centers have done a lot in that area. They've been pioneering, and they're actually evolving to help in some of these ways. So when I first started volunteering at a crisis pregnancy center, you know, years ago, the thing that we offered was a free pregnancy test, because pregnancy tests then were expensive. Now they're not so expensive. I think you can get them at the dollar store. So what pregnancy centers now by and large offer are ultrasounds, sonograms for pregnant women, and mobile sonograms. And now the next thing that I've heard is that more and more they are moving into the area of providing more holistic health care. So it is a natural evolution that is happening within crisis pregnancy centers, that they are expanding their services in order to, you know, just kind of the crisis pregnancy is the immediate felt need, but they are reaching out to address the more holistic concerns that lead to or can hopefully prevent that from happening. So I really would like to see more Christians consider. There was actually a profile done of a young woman in Cosmopolitan, of all places, a couple of years ago. This article came out about this young woman who was taking, who was establishing somewhere in the Midwest these kinds of pro-life centers that offer every healthcare service to women, except of course for abortion, but very holistic. So this is, I think, the next step for Christian pro-life advocates to get behind.
So this next question is one that it really depends who you ask, and people will be very adamant about their answer that they know it. It's not disputed that tax dollars go to Planned Parenthood. That's fact. Everyone knows that. But do taxes go to pay for abortions at Planned Parenthood?
Well, again, this is getting into beyond statistics into economics. So I don't really, but I think what Planned Parenthood is legitimately able to say is, I mean, if you get tax support, I mean, all you have to do is just, you know, say it's like one person having several bank accounts, and some of the money goes into one account and some of the money goes to another account. And so it's still all part of the same larger pool. So technically, you know, there are laws saying that tax money doesn't pay for abortions, but it's still helping the overall organization. So I think that's another red herring. It's just a technicality that doesn't really get at the heart of the issue. I mean, the heart of the issue is, going back to an earlier part of the conversation, we are dependent on abortion for our American lifestyle, not as individuals, but as a culture, and of course, many individuals within that. And we have just got to, you know, we've got to first of all recognize that, and just do a paradigm shift if we ever want to see it end. I wrote in an article last year about how impossible it might seem. But if you think about some of the paradigm shifts we've had in culture on other issues that are, you know, I'm not comparing, but I'm just, the only point of comparison is just that they would at one time have seemed like things that could never change. And I think about the slave trade, or I think about even just simply the tobacco industry. I mean, that, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, the tobacco industry was a huge part of our economy, and everybody was smoking. Everyone took it for granted, and we've done a complete shift on that. There are laws and regulations, but it's not outlawed. But we as a culture have completely changed our mind and our economy and our advertising and education around smoking. I'd like to see us do that with abortion. Obviously, I think that abortion should be illegal because it's killing children. But even if we can't get to that point right away, there's so much that we can do to help people see how unhealthy abortion is for women, how unhealthy it is to live the kinds of sexual lives that end up being so dependent upon abortion. And you know, it all begins with understanding just how deeply embedded abortion is in our society, I think. And finding that not acceptable. I mean, it just, even if you're pro-choice, I don't know how you can think that that's acceptable.
Well, and I think that answer is part of why I thought you would be so perfect to talk about this, because, you know, like I said, there are some pro-lifers who will adamantly say that tax dollars go to abortion. And of course, pro-choicers who say, no, a dollar never goes to abortion. And of course, there's subtlety in the real fact there. And it seems like the real fact is that, no, when an abortion takes place at Planned Parenthood, they're not marking that down somewhere and the government is reimbursing them for that expense. But there are a lot of expenses that Planned Parenthood gets tax money for so that they don't have to spend their abortion money on, it sounds like. Right. There is subtlety there, but it does feel like people are saying, hey, don't worry, we're pouring water into this side of the bathtub, not that side of the bathtub.
Right. And it comes down to ultimately kind of some word or numbers games, when what we just really need to be concerned about is abortion. I mean, I don't care less about the child whose life is taken by my tax dollars than I want do the one whose mom's great expensive health insurance coverage paid for. I mean, to me, that's not a big issue to me. A big issue to me is making a society that's more welcoming to women who are pregnant, whether the pregnancy is wanted or not, and to their children, and to support families. It's not as important to me, you know, that's where I want my tax dollars to go.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I can understand there's often a sentiment in the pro-choice movement that just says, like, if you don't like abortion, don't get one, but don't let me do what I want to do. But when your tax dollars are going to support the organization who does them, then we're being involved in that.
Right. And I mean, and that's just not, that's not even a legitimate moral argument to make. We don't say, oh, if you don't like nuclear weapons, don't buy one.
Yeah. Don't like war, don't go to war.
Yeah. I mean, it just, that's just not even worthy of a bumper sticker, but, yeah, we've got to get beyond those things.
So I wonder if we could talk about appropriate responses from Christians towards abortion. And I say that because I feel that there have been a lot of unhelpful responses, general shaming, sure, and shaming, you know, pro-choice people, but women who've had abortions and maybe going through some things and need to be loved by Christians around them. And then even extreme examples of violence towards abortion doctors. And so I wonder how we carry forward, where we give dignity to the people that we disagree with and do something, be a force for good at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I understand that. When we, you know, I hear when people talk about how, you know, that if we believe that abortion really is killing children, which I do, how can we countenance the people who do that as individuals, whether it's the mothers or the abortion doctors? And I guess my answer to that is this is the kind of sin that's systemic. And so there is a communal responsibility for it. I mean, I believe that, you know, that the women who get abortions, yes, they are individually culpable for that decision, but there's also a communal guilt too, because we as a society, we the people, have voted in legislators. And even if I didn't do it myself, I have not, you know, we live in a democracy. It's up to me to convince people otherwise. We have voted people in who've passed these laws and so forth. And when something is legal, the law is a teacher. And so our culture has made this acceptable, and we will have to take guilt, accept the guilt collectively. I mean, again, I think of an analogy that's helpful, but is still just as complex is slavery. I mean, it's easy for us to look back at the people in the 18th century who supported slavery and didn't see how evil it was. And it's easy for us to say, well, I would never have done that. But we don't really know for sure, because we can't see past or see through the kind of cultural water we're swimming in. And so that just really tempers my judgment of the people who are caught up in this business, whether it's the giving or receiving end. And surely there are people who are just simply depraved and evil involved in this. I just finished reading the horrific account of Kermit Gosnell, the late term abortionist who ended up killing a number of born infants. And it's just, but the thing is, he did not operate alone. The state and federal agencies that had oversight of him were absent and, you know, missing in action for years and years and years, and allowed it to go on. So there's a lot of accounting we have to do as a culture. But ultimately, I'm pro-life because I believe in the value and worth and dignity of every human being. And that includes the people that I disagree with. And it even includes those who provide abortions. And so their lives are valuable too. There will be justice at some point. But I want to win them over as well.
I don't know about, you may disagree and that's okay, but I refuse to believe that the only thing I can do, or the most important thing I can do, is vote. Because, you know, we just had this election where Donald Trump was voted into office, many by pro-life people for pro-life reasons. But I refuse to believe that I had to vote for a man who, in my opinion, every other thing about his life does not value the sanctity of life. And so I have to believe that outside of that system, there are important things that I can do as a Christian.
Absolutely. I mean, if we look back, there's a great little book. It's a kind of a classic called Third Time Around. And the author's name is escaping me, but he basically calls the pro-life movement of the 20th century the third time around of the movement, and finds its beginnings with the early Christians in ancient Greece and Rome, who went about saving the infants who'd been left abandoned to die in the wilderness or along the city walls. And they lived in a very anti-life culture and were in no position to change the laws. But they succeeded in cultivating a pro-life culture within that culture as Christians, and saving the lives of babies and helping families and promoting a pro-life ethic that is the one that we've inherited today. So there's a lot of things that can be done apart from the political and legislative realm. And we just need to have a multi-pronged effort and work on them all.
You know, one of the things that I find so insidious about abortion is that for other issues, when you are trying to, when people try to rally others to their cause, the thing that you do is you let survivors tell their story. And there are so very few survivors of abortion that that kind of takes care of itself.
And so we're left with the silence of those very important voices. I mean, there are some out there. There are some.
Yeah.
But yeah, their voices will never get to be heard, and that just makes our job really a lot harder. That's a sobering but true insight.
So I wonder if there are any resources that you want to share, whether it's resources of actual like organizations that have pregnancy centers that help in those real tangible ways, or even if it's books or articles or things like that that you want to share.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think almost every community does have a pro-life pregnancy center somewhere nearby, and they shouldn't be hard to find. Some of them are part of a network. Some of them are just sort of standalones. And I think those, I'm really fond of those centers. I put in a lot of years serving and leading them. And I think there's so many ways that one can assist and help them. And it's direct assistance to the lives of those who are being affected by potential abortion decisions. So I would first recommend the crisis pregnancy centers. I would then, you know, I think people who might just be wondering or doubting about some of these numbers we've thrown around, just get on the official websites of Planned Parenthood, its research arm, Alan Guttmacher Institute, or even just the government pages, the National Health Institute, Institute of Health, where these numbers are, and just take a look at them and know the facts and see how sobering they are. There's a lot of data about the ages of women getting abortions. More than half of the women who get abortions are in their 20s and 30s. So it's not, you know, it's not just the young girls that we think are so vulnerable. Just to get a better picture of what is going on. I think that just being armed with knowledge and then being ready to help and serve.
Planned Parenthood's own research wing gives away or states the number of abortions that are done every year.
Oh, yeah, they have so many statistics and the reasons that women give for getting the abortion, the ages, religious affiliation. They're a treasure trove of data, and it's data, you know, straight from the horse's mouth. It's not from a pro-life organization. It's from Planned Parenthood's own research arm.
That is fascinating. I had no idea. And,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Alan Guttmacher, Guttmacher. And then the other thing, again, this is just because I read it and it's just heavy on my mind. Reed Gosnell, America's Serial Killer. I don't remember the subtitle. It is eye-opening. Every person, every pro-life and every pro-choice person should be reading this book because there are so many failures at every level of government and community. And it wasn't just the babies that were dying. There were women dying in his clinic, and he was allowed to operate for years and years. And pro-choice people especially should be concerned about not allowing that kind of thing to continue. Highly recommend that book. It's riveting and horrific.
Karen, thank you so much. And I will, for listeners, all those things you just mentioned, I'll provide some links on the show notes. So be sure to check that out. Karen, thanks so much for just sharing your experiences and your expertise and talking with me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I hope that I've helped people raise some more questions and think things through a little bit more. I don't have all the answers, but if we just care about this issue and start asking these questions, I think it'll go a long ways.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SEMINARYDROPOUT, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go Check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,